With us now is Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. He's also chairman of the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. Congressman, great to have you back here.
It's great to be back.
All right, I want to get to foreign policy and the situation in Israel, but first, some business closer to home for you. Back in D.C., a lot of movement yesterday and today, a caucus meeting last night, a Republican conference. You all heard from Steve Scalise and Jim Jordan. There was a discussion, a forum, questions, that sort of thing. And then there was a vote today between those two to be the next nominee for Speaker. Steve Scalise won somewhat narrowly, but by double digits, is my understanding. Jim Jordan has thrown his support behind Steve Scalise for Speaker, but sounds like there won't be a vote today in all likelihood because he's still, Scalise is, not close to the 217 overall majority in the House he would need in that vote, that roll call vote, with everyone sitting in their seats, as we saw over and over again back in January. So that's like the lay of the land up to the minute. What can you tell us about this process as you have been personally involved in it, even just dating back to last night and what you heard from those two candidates?
Well, I think the process, the ground has somehow shifted from what used to be the tradition, if not the explicit rule in the caucus, which is whoever got the majority vote, the caucus would then unite behind that person. We have a secret ballot. Whoever gets the most votes, provided it's a majority, everyone on the floor would support that person. And that is what I thought going into this would happen in this case. And even some of the eight who voted to depose McCarthy said they would be fine with either of the two candidates who are running for speaker. But the fact that we are not going expeditiously to the floor suggests to me that we still have some holdouts and not everyone is willing to abide by that principle, which further reinforces, I think, the dangerous precedent that was set by the eight who deposed McCarthy, which is that we can be held hostage by a very small number of members. And with a narrow majority in the House, that's very difficult. And then, of course, there's the obvious point, which is we can't do anything until we have a speaker. That is at least the interpretation that the Speaker pro tem, Patrick McHenry, has of his responsibilities. I think it's probably right, though I would like to move expeditiously on certain things related to Israel. We need to select a speaker before we go forward. So my hope is that even those who wanted Jordan over Scalise, now that the internal vote is over, will rally behind Steve Scalise, that we can move to a vote tonight or at the latest tomorrow, and then get on with the business, because our business is getting increasingly important and overdue.
On just one parliamentary point that you just made, I want to focus on that for a second, because we had Kevin McCarthy on this show yesterday. And one of the things that he said in a pretty newsworthy interview was he said, in his opinion, Patrick McHenry is the acting Speaker of the House, and based on the whole purpose of having that position and creating it after 9/11, that person should have the authority. In his belief, this is McCarthy telling me yesterday, that McHenry or whoever is that Speaker pro tem, that effective acting Speaker, can indeed preside over votes. Do you think that's possibly true, and how could that proposition be tested if this process keeps dragging and dragging?
I mean, I think there's sufficient ambiguity that reasonable people could interpret it either way. The question is whether you want someone who was not elected to that position and rather was just written, his name was written by the outgoing speaker on a secret piece of paper, to wield the power over what we vote on and what we don't vote on. I guess if there were some emergency, and perhaps the argument is that what's happening in Israel is that emergency,
right,
you could sort of stretch the precedent, and there's no clear rule against it. But I think McHenry's view is that he exists to facilitate, as Speaker pro tem, he exists to facilitate the expeditious selection of a new speaker. And I do think that's the right precedent to set. But obviously we're dealing with something for which there is no precedent, really. This is the first time we've removed the speaker in history. It's a consequential event. And I think McHenry and McCarthy would tell you honestly that there's a lot we're figuring out in near real time as we deal with this unprecedented situation.
Yeah, and that's, I just keep coming back to this, and I ask the question last week I was pretty fed up with everything. What is the point of this? I've never been a gigantic Kevin McCarthy fan, you know, fanboy, something like that. Yeah, he's fine, and he's done a pretty good job as speaker, and I agree with some of the things he's done, and a few other things I think were kind of not my cup of tea, but whatever. Like, he was the Speaker of the House. I didn't see the point in throwing him out. It felt like the very small handful who teamed up with the Democrats to throw him out didn't really have any sort of plan or alternative or point. And then here we are with two speaker options, with a majority saying, okay, let's go behind Scalise. And there are people saying, no, I'm still with McCarthy. No, I'm still with Jordan. No, I might vote present. I might not vote for any of these people. What is the point of this? There's a crisis internationally. There's a lot of business to get done on the home front. Republicans don't have a lot of power in Washington right now. The House is the one exception, at least nominally. And it's all paralyzed for this. And it just, I don't understand substantively what the objective is here. It all seems very embarrassing and just kind of like self-destructive and nihilistic for no good reason. And maybe I'm missing some sort of really important principle here. And if I am, please enlighten me.
Perhaps the most generous interpretation you could take of the effort to depose the speaker, which, of course, I did not support, and I largely agree with your analysis. I think what's happening now shows that there was no real plan. But the most generous interpretation you could take is that it is a expression of frustration with the broken budgeting and appropriations process. And nobody can defend that process, but nobody can fix it overnight, which is why I think the best case scenario for what remains of this Congress is that we select a new speaker. We do move out on certain areas where I think there is sufficient unity or bipartisanship to advance a policy agenda, Israel being one of them. There's a lot of things I've been working on the China committee that I think we can pass in overwhelming fashion. But, and it's a big but, recognizing that with a narrow majority and a divided government, there's limits to the conservative policy agenda you can advance, because the Senate won't go along with it and the president will veto it, even if it gets up Congress. Focus instead on the process. Focus on fixing the broken plumbing of Congress, all sort of the boring, less sexy procedural fixes to our budgeting and appropriations process. I actually think there's a lot of bipartisan frustration, and I think whoever the next speaker is, could make a big impact, even with this narrow majority, if they focused on fixing the process as opposed to just trying to
own
the libs for 15 months. You know what I mean? Or fight harder. And somehow
I'm all for that. And there are certain governing realities that you just referenced. And, okay, you gave the charitable interpretation, at least theoretically, of the deposing of McCarthy, that whole little cabal. What's the point of now holding up the new speaker in waiting or speaker nominee? Like, what's the point of that?
There's no point. So, which is why the uncharitable interpretation or hypothesis does have a lot of evidence behind it, which is that this isn't actually about principle. It isn't actually about process. It's about, you know, scoring points or getting clicks or raising money. I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody's motivations. I don't know what they are. I think that's a dangerous game to go down. But it's hard for me right now to see a coherent plan lurking behind the intransigence, other than everyone's upset and everybody. We keep destroying all the norms and unwritten rules of Congress, which are necessary to operate. I would submit some of the most important rules are unwritten, and you know, the more we start to erode those norms, the more chaotic the institution becomes. But to kind of get back to my first point, Guy, you know, these people feel certain people feel no loyalty to the institution because the institution has grown so weak since the 70s, right? That is sort of the reality of our constitutional system today. The legislature, with the framers feared as being too powerful, has grown so weak. And really, it's surrendered its authority to the executive branch that people start to lose faith in the process, and they channel their energy and their ambitions into media. Right? We sort of turn Congress into the green room.
But I would just say, Totally agree. I would just say the institution can be weak. At times it can be very strong. And when the Democrats were running it, and they had Nancy Pelosi in charge with a pretty iron fist and a big gavel, when they needed to get stuff done for their ideological project, they stuck together and they did it. And their alleged moderates and their yellers on the left all just eventually grit their teeth and did the thing because politics is a team sport. And Republicans clearly, again, aren't doing that. You've got the Democrats and the media, one and the same, trying to argue from day one that the House Republican majority is dysfunctional and a clown show. And it seems like there are some Republicans absolutely fanatically committed to proving them right. You're like, yes, can confirm. Just quickly before we move to Israel in our final minutes together, Congressman, I take it you are a supporter now. You're in favor of Speaker Scalise becoming a thing, number one. And number two, do you think there will be a Speaker of the House, let's say, by the close of business tomorrow? Does that seem realistic to you?
Yes, I hope we can unite behind Scalise. And yes, I'm cautiously optimistic about our ability to produce a speaker by the close of business tomorrow. You can play against me when I'm wrong. Okay? So you can play it on loop on your show.
I'll take the other side of that bet. Yeah, we'll bet a beer on that. I'm going to say no. You're going to say yes. I'd be happy to be wrong, but I'm going to vote no on this one. That's the bet. The beer of your choice, sir. Okay, finally, very seriously, part of the reason that I think there's a new sense, or should be a newfound sense of urgency. It's not just some partisan game. It's not some self-aggrandizement game. There are things happening in the world, big things happening, including one of our most important allies under attack, 1,200 people murdered, dozens of Americans murdered or missing, held hostage. The president rightly wants to send more aid, military aid, to Israel. That is widely supported across party lines. Can't do anything until there's a Speaker of the House. What should the House, when it's finally functional again, Congressman, what should the House do given what has happened to Israel in recent days?
A few things. One, we have a bipartisan resolution that McCall and Meeks have worked on, which, though just a resolution, I do think would send a strong signal of bipartisan support for Israel. Two, we are going to need to replenish the War Reserve Stock Allies program, which supplies critical munitions to Israel, things like ammo for Iron Dome. We need to ensure that Israel doesn't run out of those things. And three, and maybe this doesn't lend itself to bipartisanship, in my opinion, this should put a stake in the heart of the Biden administration's efforts to achieve detente with Iran. And I will be calling upon or sending a letter to the administration urging them to freeze the $6 billion that we're paying to Iran in return for hostages. I would also include the $10 billion that we waive to allow Iraq to pay Iran, as well as fully enforced sanctions. Really, the broader regional point here is that our attempts to make nice with Iran have failed. Iran is the primary chaos agent in the Middle East, and our only hope of achieving stability is to build an alliance structure in opposition to Iran and its terrorist proxies. Hamas is obviously a terrorist proxy of Iran. So those would be the three steps I hope we can move out on.
Except the administration is arguing that there's no direct evidence tying Iran to this attack. What do you make of that?
Well, except for the decades in which Iran has provided weapons, training, and financial assistance to Hamas, and just given the sort of intelligence failures leading up to this terrorist war on Israel, I would say right now it's fair to say that the absence of evidence is not evidence. So clearly, Hamas and Iran have a shared goal, which is wiping Israel off the map and killing as many Jews as possible. And certainly if Hezbollah gets involved in a second front on the north and attacked Israel, they wouldn't do that without Iran's assistance.
And there's reporting that Iran was directly involved in the planning. Hamas has thanked Iran for all of their help in the planning and equipping and execution of this horrible attack. So I guess there is no direct evidence implicating Iran, except for all the evidence. We'll have to leave it at that and come back to it another day, hopefully when there's a functional House of Representatives, perhaps tomorrow. If not, I get a beer from Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin. Congressman, as always, we appreciate your time. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Jack.